Well, everybody got quiet, so that can only mean one thing. It's time to get started. Exodus chapter 24 tonight. Exodus 24. Kind of like I told y'all Sunday morning, missing last Wednesday, and I'm grateful that John stepped in. I heard he did a really good job, which I have no doubt of. Sure seems like it's been a month since I've been with y'all, and instead of just, you know, a week of not being here on a Wednesday night. And we had concluded Exodus 23, and I gave John the opportunity, if he wanted to jump into 24, and he said, nah, I'll let you take that. So we find ourselves in Exodus 24 tonight, and if you'll, by way of remembrance, and, you know, we've actually spent quite a while going through the details, what is called the Book of the Covenant. You know, the Ten Commandments were early on the Decalogue, and then we kind of been expanding, or God has been expanding, on what all that looks like and looking at some very details around some very important things and things in regards to, you know, how we treat fellow man, how we treat aliens and sojourners, property stuff, your neighbor's ox. I mean, all that stuff we've been looking at for the past couple of months, probably, I guess. And that's after all this major, huge events that happened at the start of Exodus. You're like, man, I remember the Ten Commandments. There's a whole lot of other stuff, these big events. Well, some of that is in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But we're going to get to some of it pretty soon. But we're kind of, I don't want to say we're past that Book of the Covenant language, but we are kind of past that. It'll still be referenced some. Tonight, the scene shifts a little bit. I'm pretty excited what we're going to be looking at tonight because of that shift in scene. Although I got much more out of looking at those details of these laws than I think maybe we would have when we just read through them as we're looking through all these details of these laws. But tonight we come to another pretty big event, really. It's not the Red Sea parting. It's not the plagues being sent, but it's a pretty significant event nonetheless. Some of your Bibles that might have a chapter title or something like that, maybe say something like ratification of the covenant, or God cuts his covenant with Israel, or something to that nature. Kind of this ratification of this covenant is what we see here. And you might say, well, that doesn't sound that exciting. Well, just hold on. It deals with this kind of this climax of the covenant making process, and the ceremony that seals it is going to be talked about in this text. There's different parts of this ritual, I guess you could say, and how all that connects to what covenant making looks like, especially in the ancient Near East. So with all that said, let me just go ahead and open some prayer before we dive in. Father, we thank you for bringing us here this evening, Lord, that we are able to come together as brothers and sisters and enjoy time with one another, Lord. Enjoy opening your word and studying together. Lord, I ask your blessing upon those who couldn't be with us tonight for whatever reason that might be. I ask your blessing upon Michelle and the kids next door as they open your word as well. And God, I just pray that you would add your blessing to our study this evening, and that all that we do and all that we say is done so in a way that brings you honor and glory, because you alone are worthy of all our praise. It is in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. As I looked at this, you know, oftentimes when I look at a text or starting a new chapter, of how does it break up? Is there natural breaks, or do I have to make an unnatural break in it to expand upon it or expound upon it, not expand upon it? There's really only one kind of pause point in this text in my mind, is in regards to how the details are laid out, and it's really after verse 11. However, there are little piece parts that we can stop and look at instead of reading that big of a chunk of it, just in case the Lord causes us to tarry a little bit longer in a certain section. So with all that said, let's just start with verse 1 and read the first couple of verses, and then we'll talk about it. Then he, God, said to Moses, "Come up to Yahweh the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you all shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to Yahweh the Lord, but they shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him." Let's just go ahead and stop right there for now. So God is talking to these different groups of people. How would you categorize these two, three groups of people? It's Moses and Aaron, and then you get Nadab and Abihu, and then the 70 elders of Israel. You shall all worship at a distance. And then he tells Moses, but you can come near. So has Nadab and Abihu been introduced yet in the book of Exodus? Who are these people? Sons of Aaron. Who is Aaron? We didn't talk about Aaron in a while either. He's the brother of Moses, right? And then these 70 ruling elders, where do they come from? We've talked about these elders once or twice. We've talked about these people that were set apart earlier on. It doesn't really give us a whole lot of detail here. With all that said, why 70? You're not supposed to have all the answers tonight. Why 70? What does the number 70 represent in Scripture? Completion. A completion, a totality, a symbolic of that, the wholeness of Israel, maybe? This is an exceptional scene because the scene is shifting. What did God tell them a few chapters back about coming close to the mountain? Not to or what? You'll die. Remember, he even told them to keep the livestock away from it. Don't even let your cow touch the mountain because I'll kill it. That's back in Exodus 19. So there's a shift in focus. There's a kind of a shift in what we're looking at. The entire book of the covenant, as I said, we've been looking at that since chapter 20, I think, has been explained and expounded upon by God and through Moses as mediator. And then he says that he's talking to Moses and he tells him what to do. So again, he's the mediator of everything. Now, I asked you if we had talked about Nadab and Abihu. They were mentioned earlier, but it's so long ago, none of us remembered. Exodus 6, 35. And Aaron took Eliashib, the daughter of Aminadab, the sister of Nashon, as a wife, and she bore him Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. So we did hear about them, but chapter 6 seems like a lifetime ago compared to where we are now. So they were brought up already. Sons of Aaron, they stand in the priestly Levitical line of leadership. They great privileges. What do we know about them later? Whoa, everybody knows that answer, or at least three of y'all do. You know it well enough you wanted to make sure we heard it.
Right.
What did you say, Brother James?
They gave strange fire before the Lord.
Okay. What did the other James say?
Just said they died.
They died, okay. And what did you say, Diane?
They died,
okay.
After the strange fire.
After the strange fire. That's what I say. So James starts us off. They offer strange fire, and they were killed for it. What do we mean by that? Well, they offered up this at the tabernacle, something God had not prescribed for, and that's found in Leviticus 10 if you want to go check that out later. We're not going to get to that in our study of Exodus.
They probably put some gasoline on
them. Oh my goodness, Charles. Brother Charles said they're throwing gas on the fire. That would be strange indeed considering the timeline, wouldn't it? So the verb used to go up is used 7 times in this chapter. The Hebrew verb for go up shouldn't come as a surprise to us. This to go up, that's what they had to do to go to the mountain. The 7th time the word appears is when Moses reaches the summit of Sinai, goes into the cloud and remains there for 40 days. That's kind of on the back end of this chapter. And verse 2 tells us, Moses alone, however, shall come near to Yahweh the Lord, but they shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him. So after being told this, at this point, it seems like almost there's 3 levels of where they're to go, right? These that have been pointed out can go this far, or Moses goes here, this group goes here, then the other group's left down. So Moses was permitted to approach it, but these others that are mentioned here are going to be able to do something God had told them he would kill them for just a few chapters earlier. Would there be any anxiety in your mind to say, well, God, you told us not too long ago, if we touch this mountain, you're going to kill us. Well, at this point, he's saying that this is kind of an exception to what he said, right? Because God is directing them to do it per his direction, not per their own we're going to go test God out. Now, they're not testing God at this point. He's telling them, yes, you can come this far. All right. So, the rest of them have to remain at the foot of Mount Sinai, though, at the base of it. Verse 3. Any questions on that? Pretty straightforward. Verse 3. Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of Yahweh and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Yahweh the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of Yahweh the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. Not deep, deep stuff here, but worthy to pause again to survey the scene of what's being said and done here. What does it mean that he came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments? He's recounting everything that we've been talking about, that we've been sledging through for the past couple of months, right? All these details of the laws, what the judgments are on those laws. He's just recounting it to them, reminding them of it, telling them about it, because originally we didn't see this response from them. However, now he tells them all this, tells them all the judgments. If you do this, then this will happen. Don't do that, so this won't happen. He's going through all that, right? And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Yahweh the Lord has spoken, we will do. Now, if it ended there, we didn't know what happens when Moses actually goes up on top of the mountain, which I think several of us knows what's going to happen when he goes on top of the mountain down below. And he's going to be gone for 40 days, but still, it's no excuse. That sounds pretty good, right? Got everything you told us to do. We're going to do it. But they didn't. And we're going to see that, but it's going to be a while before we get there because it's going to take us a while to get to the end of the 40 days. It's going to be several chapters from now. But if you want to know, you got to keep coming on Wednesday nights for a while because it's going to be a minute before we get there. If you don't already know. Another way that this could be said, what my translation said, all the words which he has spoken, we will do. All the people answer with one voice. Does anybody's translation say with one accord or all together or something to that effect? Probably. It all means the same thing. Now, had they made a declaration like this before? I thought I heard somebody say, They did. 19:8, back in chapter 19, verse 8, all the people answered together and said, all that Yahweh has spoken, we will do. And Moses brought back the words of the people to Yahweh the Lord. What is that responding to? You remember? The Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, before he even started expanding on all the details of them. All sounds good to them so far. Or at least they're giving their approval to do it. And then he goes on, and Moses wrote down all the words of Yahweh the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, hold on a second. I thought this all was written in stone. I mean, that's what the movie says. What is this? Moses writing it all down right here. It's the Book of the Covenant. He does put the Ten Commandments on stone, but that's yet to come in the story of Exodus as well. But did you know that Moses wrote all this down before that? He did. Bible just told us that, verse 4. Not too hard to understand. Let's move on. The next morning he erected an altar to Yahweh, and he would certainly have done according to the laws of chapter 20. It told us to do it, how to do it, all that stuff. What is the altar to reflect or to represent? Kind of a trick question because you got to find some more stuff out later on, but it's kind of to represent the presence of God. Representative of God, or to worship, or a way to worship. What about these pillars, though? 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. We understand that, I think, but why pillars to begin with? Is this the first time we've seen something like this, of erecting these pillars? And what is a pillar to begin with? We think of a pillar, we think of a porch pillar or something, right? The, you know, an old antebellum type home with the big pillars holding the porch up, or maybe you're, you know, something like that. What is a pillar literally, though? Yeah, it's just like a stone edifice that maybe stood up. So why erect 12 pillars? We already know it symbolizes the 12 tribes of Israel because it tells us that. Why do it at all, though?
It's representing the presence of the people in front of the presence of God, called representation.
And this whole chapter is going to be about the covenant piece, right? So there's a representation of the people of Israel, 12 tribes represented, and the altar representative of God in this covenantal relationship. It's going to play a part shortly. Is this the first time we've seen this erecting of pillars, though? Maybe in Exodus, but we talked about this in Genesis.
I looked it up.
You looked it up? Where else did we see this, Diane?
When Jacob had his vision of God, he took the stone pillow and made a pillar out of it and sort of the same symbolism, I guess.
So Diane's talking about Genesis 31, verses 45 through 24, or 45 through 54. 45 through 24 wouldn't work, would it?
Genesis
28, that's okay. Well, 31 also. There's a couple of times in Genesis. Yeah, then Jacob took a stone and raised it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his relatives, gather stones. So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. And Laban called it Yegar Shadabu, but Jacob called it Galeed. Then Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore it was named Galeed in Mitzpah, for he said, may Yahweh watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. And it goes on and on. So he also talks about being a witness. A witness. Not just representative, but also a witness to what's about to take place.
Didn't they make a pile of stones after they went through the Red Sea too? And that's kind of something.
They did. Yep. When we say witness, we don't mean what it can mean to see something, but it also means a testimony to something that's about to happen as well, right? Let's go on. Any thoughts, questions on that? Everybody tracking? James is not tracking. And representative of covenant, yeah. Okay. And he sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings, sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to Yahweh the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. I know some of y'all's translations say something different there when I said sprinkled. Then he took the book of the covenant and he read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that Yahweh the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and he sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has cut with you in accordance with all these words. So the next step of this ratification, in this ratification process, Moses told the young men of Israel to offer sacrifices to God. Go get these young bulls. Two types of sacrifices. What's the two types here? A burnt offering and a peace offering. What is a burnt offering representative of in the Old Testament economy? Anybody? We haven't seen the whole picture of this yet. Leviticus 1 lays this out better. It's like an atoning sacrificial for sin offering. It's a burnt offering in the Old Testament economy. Leviticus 1, if you want to read more about that, you can read that in your spare time this evening. Or I can read you the start of it at least. Leviticus chapter 1. Then Yahweh the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man from among you brings an offering near to Yahweh, you shall bring your offering of animals from the herd of the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall bring it near a male without blemish. He shall bring it near to the doorway of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before the Lord. Lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. That's that whole concept of propitiation of someone else or something else suffering and dying for the sins of the people. We see it right here early on. Go back to my notes. The second category was for a peace offering. A peace offering. They offer burnt offerings and sacrifice young bulls as peace offerings to Yahweh. So that a peace offering really ties in with an atonement too, though, because of that you can have peace with God, like we've talked about before on Sunday mornings. What is this saying? Who God was the, as they would say in the Near East, a suzerain, and Israel was the vassal. So he's in charge, he's in control, he's making the rules, and so they're offering up the sacrifice to him who is the Lord. That would be reflected in this. But let's go in. I think we kind of get that. Verse 6 says this, that Moses now gets involved. Instead of just telling them, he actually gets involved. Literally, he gets his hands dirty or bloody. I'll be here all night. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, so like a big bowl or something like that. And the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Some of y'all's translations do not say sprinkled there. They say something else, don't they? Threw. Splashed. Sprinkled is what? Miss Judy's got the right translation back there. Anybody else have something besides threw, sprinkled, or splashed? Would you say, Susan? Mm-hmm. Splashed. The ESV actually says threw. That's what you guys have, right? Molly, what did you say yours says? No, what did it say? Threw? Yeah, that's an ESV there too. That the R.C. Sproul, yeah. Threw upon the altar. It symbolizes the presence of God. Now stay with me. It symbolizes the presence of God. And we also read that he would throw or sprinkle or splash the other half back on the people. Both people in the covenant. What is a covenant? Somebody tell me what a covenant is. We hadn't talked about covenants in a while. We talked about them a lot in Genesis, didn't we? An agreement, but it's more than just an agreement.
A vow.
I would even say...
Like a marriage.
Well, yeah, marriage is a covenant. But there's also some legal type language in that of... I'm looking for something specific.
Contract.
Like a contract, too. All of what you said is right, but it's kind of... We've got this contractual aspect of it as well, which you do this, I'll do that. In the Near East, yeah. They used to do blood tests for marriages too, but I don't think they do any bloodletting for marriages anymore.
Not necessary anymore.
Rh
factor. If the Rh negative marries the Rh positive, they have children, the female will die. And so that's why they did the blood test. You weren't allowed to get married if the other person was different.
Oh, interesting.
They just give you a shot for it. They don't even tell you about it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's thank you for our medical expert on scene here. Now that's good to know. I had no idea when they did it, why they stopped doing it.
Yeah.
But there's blood involved in this, as was said. That's an essential element of covenant making in the Bible. What is one of the oldest covenants we read about in Scripture that we read about in Genesis? Well, not one of the oldest, but the one we connect to the Hebrew people, the Israelites specifically. And I'm thinking about something that happens to the males.
Circumcision.
And there's blood present there, obviously. All through when we studied, y'all that were here with us, we went through Genesis, we saw multiple covenants that were involving blood in Genesis, didn't we? Okay, it's an essential part of covenant making in the Bible. I read one commentary that says a covenant is a bond in blood.
You cut a covenant.
It's language God uses throughout the Old Testament too, of cutting a covenant. So it's illustrated Genesis 15, 9 through 20. That's when God told Abram to bring all these animals, and God split the animals in half. And of course, obviously there's blood if you're splitting a bunch of animals in half. Caused this sleep to come on Abram, and God came through the midst of the split animals. Genesis 17, this is the circumcision speak. And then Jeremiah 34:18, and I will give the men who have trespassed against my covenant, who have not established the words of the covenant, which they cut before me, when they cut the calf in two and passed between its parts. So where Jeremiah references all the way back to that Abraham covenant. So why is blood so important from the Hebrew perspective? God talks a lot about blood. You wouldn't know any different.
Without shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness.
Without shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness of sin. But why? Why must blood be shed?
The life is in the blood.
The life is in the blood, and Scripture tells us that, and the Hebrews held tight to that. God said it, right? Life is in the blood. It talks about, you know, the bloodletting of animals and how, you know, you prepare an animal for sacrifice and all those kind of things. Life is in the blood. There's another aspect to that. When you ratify this covenant, and the covenant is ratified, a bond in blood, if we want to use that commentary I talked about, there's extremes to that, right? If life is in the blood, what else must we infer from that?
Death.
So if you're doing it in the covenant relationship, covenantal type thing, okay, there's life in this covenant if we keep to the covenant requirements. Conversely, what must that mean if you don't? Death. So, we read on, didn't we? Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. It's like he's almost like he reads it again, right? He recounted it, wrote it down. After he wrote it down, now I'm going to read it back to you. There, make no mistake about it. There was no one who could have said, I don't know what he said. I don't know what it means. I don't know what was written down. I don't know what God said, because they heard it the first time. He recounts it to them, talks about the covenant language with them, writes it down, tells them about it again. No excuse. No excuse. That's what I take from it, at least. And how did they respond this time? All that Yahweh the Lord has spoken, we will do. And we will be obedient, or you said, we'll do everything. We're going to do it. Doubling down, really, is what that is, isn't it? We're going to do it. We're going to be obedient. Well, yeah, I mean, you say you're going to do it, then you got to be obedient. No, we're going to do it, and we're going to be obedient. I mean, yes and yes. It's how I see that, what they're saying to him. So, why read it again? Well, you might find this interesting. You might not. Y'all know I'm a biblical nerd and a bit of a historical nerd. They combine sometimes for your benefit, sometimes when you don't really want to hear it, but you're going to hear it anyway. Reading of the covenant document was actual part of the ritual or rite of ratifying the covenant. We talked about it, kind of this legal type thing. It's kind of like, all right, what do you think about that marriage covenant, right? There's words you say, there's things that, and you say, I do. Reading these things, saying these things, verbalizing these things. But in the ancient Near East, it was a requirement that the pact must be read aloud and agreed upon between both parties. So what is this covenant? We just said that it's called the Book of the Covenant. God said, these are the laws. These are the. This is what you need to do. This is what I'm saying as my people you're to do. What's that?
Informed consent.
And they respond, and we will obey. We will be obedient. There's no doubt that they are agreeing to the terms of the covenant.
It's almost like God did his half first, and then they did their half. Like he confirmed his side because they did the sprinkling for the altar first.
Yeah.
And then they did the ritual, and people did it. So it's like God Like the husband says, I do, and the wife says, I do, there's two parts.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much intricate detail in all this that I think sometimes we can just read through that there's so much connective tissue to all this. Moses took the blood, threw it, sprinkled it on the people. So he'd already, we didn't really talk about the fact that he put it on the altar, did we? Or did we? We did? Okay, we did. Representative of God's part of the covenant, right? Sorry. Been a long day, week. So he takes the other part and sprinkles it on the people. Behold the blood of the covenant, which the Lord has cut with you in accordance with all these words. So what is it? What does that accomplish by throwing it on the people? This may be where my bride would have checked out. She might not have liked this piece very much. Why throw it on the people? Yeah, I mean, it's part of the covenant, right? You've already said you're going to be obedient twice, so guess what? You're going to take the blood on you. You're also saying in the sacrifice that this offering is representative of a peace offering and an atoning offering, a guilt offering. So we take the blood upon ourselves because they sacrificed their life, these animals, for us. And it ratifies the contract. They've said they were going to do it. Now it's a bond of blood. More often than, yeah. Oftentimes, yeah. So should we go back throwing blood on each other there too, Brother Charles? We throw blood on them maybe. That might make them say, I won't before they ever say I do. I don't know. They know that blood's coming.
More real.
Yeah. Might mess up the white dress, I guess, but anyway. That's where we stopped at, right? Let's pick up verse 9. Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. So now we're kind of back to the start of what he said to do. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet for there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire. Some of y'all have the longer word there. As clear as the sky itself. Hold on a minute. They saw God? Did they see God? How different is that from everything we've seen up to this point? I mean, first of all, you can come and touch the mountain now. Now he's going to give these select group some kind of theophany, some kind of view of him. And it's almost like it's just thrown in there. I mean, you would think, we see these pictures in like Isaiah and Ezekiel of this picture of the throne room of God, and it takes half the chapter even talk about it, and part of it is kind of a blur to him to begin with. This is almost thrown out. What do y'all think about that? Okay. You heard what Diane said? Since this covenant was such a major deal that this is an exception. And a purification involved. So because of the purification that had just happened, perhaps gave them that right.
Yeah, because earlier, it's, you know, stick your face in a rock and don't turn around. You're going to pass behind.
The Bible said, I mean, Hebrew people clearly understood, and God has said, you cannot look upon the face of God and live.
They weren't worthy.
Well, they were covered in this purification for a moment to begin with. That's the other thing. It doesn't say they saw his face.
Saw his feet, whatever else.
They saw his feet and what's under his feet. Mm-hmm. But God's spirit. Bible tells us God's spirit. In a theophany, here we go with these fancy words again. A theophany is a physical manifestation or representation of God. The burning bush is a theophany. God spoke from this bush that was representative of who he was, and he used it in that way. I don't know what all they saw. Some of y'all have this word, lapis lazuli, right there, right? It's this bluish stone, and it's further identified because I also said, as clear as the sky itself. Some of y'all's translations actually say heaven right there, don't they? King James, New King James probably. Sapphire, what, let me see. Like the heavens in its clearness. So the heavens, we use heaven in other places, right? The heavens declare his glory, talking about the heavens. What else is talking about heavens is the sky, the covering also. This beautiful blue color and picture, and it's as bright and clear as heaven itself. It was almost as if you can only imagine. Where are they at? Let's pause for a second. Where are they at again? Mount Sinai. Where's Mount Sinai at? Well, there's a little bit of debate on that, but generally speaking, Mount Sinai is located in what kind of region or environment? It's a desert environment. They're given this beautiful picture that's totally out of place, which you would expect if you're getting some kind of glimpse of who God is, this beautiful, glorious blue in the midst of all this other stuff going on too. You may translation say a pavement right there. It's all blue pavement. Devouring fire right there in verse 10. It's going to say it here in just a little bit.
Yeah,
but no, you're good. You're good. Okay. You're good. You said that. Like, I think that's coming pretty soon.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this tiled floor. Okay, any other thoughts there? I mean, this is an amazing thing that we just walked up to, isn't it? I mean, think about everything we've been studying for the past few months, then we have this. Okay, nobody has any further comments on that. Tony's looking for something else to hit me with over there. But I glanced over and he's flipping through a Bible. I'm like, he's fixing to give me something good. He disappointed me. Verse 11, yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they beheld God and they ate and drank. Whoa. What's he saying there? He had every right to strike them down, even though he invited them up there because he's God. He didn't. What did he do instead? They ate and they drank.
Together.
Well, it doesn't 100% say that. That God ate with them. It does say, though, that they ate and drank there. In his presence.
Yeah, together in God's presence.
Yeah, they were together. Why did they eat while they're up there, first of all? I mean, we're all Baptists. We don't have no problem gathering together to eat. But why did they eat? Is there any thoughts there?
Well, they didn't bring the food with them.
Okay, that's a good point.
So, it had God provided the food. So
God provided food.
God asked, so here's an animal meat, we're eating it
too. Okay. Okay, celebration. We bring the wedding thing up again because it's a covenant. A wedding, a marriage is a covenant. What's that? Okay, now we have comment about Lord's Supper. Marty's wanting to go deep with this now.
In verse 10, it says God of Israel. And then down in 11, where we are now, it says they saw God. Are they making some kind of distinction?
I don't think so. I think 10 is just a clarity, because the other thing you notice I didn't say is I didn't say Yahweh. So that's, it wasn't the personal name of him here. It was the Elohim of Israel. So no, I don't think there's making a distinction so much as a clarification. And since I've already clarified who he is here, then I don't have to add that the second time. That's the way I see it there. It's the same Hebrew word used both times. They beheld God, they ate and they drank. We've already talked about, we had the marriage, thing about the marriage. Marty made a comment about the Lord's Supper. Let me say something else here. Nobody pointed this part out that it said, I figure somebody would say, well, Greg, you just told us maybe they didn't see all of him. Diane said they didn't see his face. You say, well, in verse 11, it says, and they beheld God. Y'all's translation say that? Beheld God?
Saw
God, even. Well, y'all were just trying to act like all they saw was his feet. This sounds like it said they saw more. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put words in your mouth, Diane. Maybe that's what I said.
There they saw the God of Israel.
So yours says saw also. The verb translated beheld here, or saw, or see, or seen, or whatever, is not the normal Hebrew word meaning to see. Cleared that all up for you, didn't I? Made it more confusing, right?
Yeah, what's the original word?
It's a, this word right here. So before we go down that path, this word they use right here is actually a stronger, more intense word of seeing something than the normal run-of-the-mill see something. This word, the Hebrew word used here, is the typical term used, especially in Genesis, when they had a prophetic vision. That God actually did peel something back of the curtain and let them see more than what you could typically see. It does not say beheld his face, and I think there's a reason why, because I don't think God showed them that. So, final ratification of the covenant occurs here with a covenantal meal. This was the ceremony that depicts joy. I think you said something about celebration or something to that effect earlier. Joy and peace between the Lord and Israel. The final act wasn't the throwing of the blood. The final act was the consummation of it with a meal. And this was a Near Eastern custom, and it still is a custom in the Near East today. And we see it in our culture today. Marriage is a good example of that. So what do we see as New Testament believers, as Christians, as we can debate on some other things, but the primarily two sacraments, right? Baptism and Lord's Supper, communion. These are sacred ceremonies. They substantiate and they confirm the covenant relationship between God and his people. Not transubstantiate. I don't want to go too deep down this, but that's where the Catholic Church and some others think that when you go to the Lord's table in communion, that that is really his flesh and really his blood, that he transforms it literally. Which is interesting because even at the Last Supper, that's not literally what they were eating and drinking, right? Even the original setup of it wasn't that. It was bread and wine. A lot of it was, for sure. And he calls the cup of wine his blood. He calls the literal bread his flesh. Yeah. So anyway, just so you know, you ever hear that word transubstantiation? Probably not going to hear it in your run-of-the-mill conversations tomorrow, but that's what it means. And even some of the reformers that broke from the Catholic Church still had held on to some of that. Martin Luther wrestled with that greatly. Yeah, yeah, it does. Diane referenced, I read this verse the first of every Sunday, Luke 22:20. And in the same way, he, Jesus, took the cup after they'd eaten, saying, "This cup, which is poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood." At the Last Supper, at this meal, was the ratification of that. But it's kind of backwards because the blood will be spilt the next day. The Catholics do for sure. I think the Anglican Church might. There's some schisms within the Presbyterian churches who lean that way too. So we think about the Lord's Supper. Yeah, Marty.
See God or see any part of him, you'd have to be without seeing. Yeah. You know, I think he would see his feet. I mean,
opinion.
Yeah.
So I think.
So you're saying if they'd have waited 30 minutes or an hour after that, they had to go straight up there right then. Yeah.
Don't take us long to mess up.
Obviously, they didn't stub their toe on the mountain walking up or any trip or anything either, because then they'd have been had to come back down the mountain. I see what you're saying, brother. Any other thoughts on that? I don't think there's a tremendous amount of detail in this second part. Well, yeah, there is too, but let's read through it and see if we can get through this second half of this. We may not. Unless there's more discussion y'all want on what we just looked at. All right. Giddy up. Verse 12. Now Yahweh the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction." So Moses arose with Joshua, his attendant, some translations say minister there, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. Because to the elders, he said, "Remain here for us," so this is Moses speaking, "until we return to you, and behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them." Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. And the glory of Yahweh the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. And the appearance of the glory of Yahweh was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop in the eyes of the sons of Israel. Then Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. A glorious scene just became even more glorious. The Lord told Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandments." So, all right, there is the stone tablets coming up, right? The Ten Commandments are going to be written on stone tablets. So, true. You come up. Here's what I find as interesting as maybe anything else in all this. Verse 13. Moses arose with Joshua's attendant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. Moses, did God tell Moses to bring Joshua up there too? He didn't, did he? 4 we get there, God tells Moses to come higher up the mountain. Everybody else has got to stay, right? They made it this far, but no further. Moses, you're coming to the top. I'm going to give you the stone tablets, and there'll be other things going on there too, as we'll see pretty soon. So we've talked about the stone tablets. There's two tablets of stone. Where do we see that? Well, Exodus 34, he'll have them. Deuteronomy 4:13 talks about them. We learn that they're written from the finger of God. Exodus 31:18. So all that's true that you think about. Okay, I'm not going to destroy any of that for y'all. That's true and biblical. I'll wait till we get there. But there's something interesting because in our mind, maybe y'all don't think this way. In our mind, that probably this is that picture from the Ten Commandments movie. There's two stone tablets. Maybe I shouldn't go into this too deep, but I'll say this. Were 5 on one and 5 on the other, or maybe 4 on one and 6 on the other?
Some I don't. Longer and some shorter.
I think they were both identical tablets. All 10 were on this one, all 10 were on that one. Sure. We'll get to that when we get to it. There's biblical evidence to back that up. There's another 40 days and 40 nights to think about too. Jesus' time of temptation. And numbers are important too. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, and I'm trying to keep myself from getting ahead of myself too. Susan was already trying to read the last verse half an hour ago. That may be her telling me to. It may be her trying to tell me to hurry up. I don't know. Joshua is mentioned here only for the second time in the book of Exodus. He's mentioned back in 17. He's loyal to Moses. We know after Moses, Joshua takes the reins, right? He will be the one that actually leads them into the promised land. And he's kind of a warrior prophet. Joshua's an interesting guy, a very interesting guy. We may go to there when we complete Exodus. I don't know yet, but it's the book of Joshua. He's called the minister of Moses. Some of y'all see. He'll keep that right up until the time of Moses' death. Joshua 1:1. Now it came about after the death of Moses. Spoiler alert. Moses dies. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that Yahweh spoke to Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' attendant. You have something?
He's probably a lot younger than Moses, so he might have been just sort of helping him because
I think that is a big part of it, Diane. Is it minister, attendant? Because I looked up that Hebrew word. I'm like, what does that word mean? Because
it's assistant.
Assistant, servant. He was attending to Moses.
Moses probably wasn't as agile to climb mountains. Anymore.
Yeah, he wasn't. He wasn't quite spry like he used to be. I mean, this is. How old do we think Moses was at this point? His life happened in 40-year increments, right?
Mm-hmm.
40, 80, 120. Mm-hmm. This is near the end, not too far from it. They didn't have wheelchairs, no. But get some of Brother Charles's gas they poured on the fires back then, though, maybe.
They had to help him hold up his arms.
They had to help him hold up his arms during the battle. You're right. That's another good point to bring up. So Joshua didn't stay with the elders. He came to a higher level with Moses. Now, he's not going to go up into the cloud, okay?
Yeah.
And even the movie gets this part right, doesn't it? If y'all, the Ten Commandments movie, he stays a little further down. Who gave Moses the right to say, bring Joshua with you? God didn't tell him to.
Nope, didn't say
he couldn't, Diane.
Well, God may perhaps told him to bring Joshua.
That sounds like a Diane answer right there, for sure.
Just not, oh, she said that too?
No.
I didn't say that.
She didn't. She didn't. Did you have... I thought I saw somebody else have something there. What are your thoughts? Anybody else? I think a lot of it is the fact that it was known that he was his attendant and his servant, and that it was just obvious that he was going to go with him as far as he'd let him, Mike.
Bottom line is he didn't invite him to bring him with him.
God didn't invite him to bring him with him. You're right. That is the bottom line.
But possibly God had already chose Joshua to be his successor.
Oh, you know he did.
That was whether he had made it known.
Right. Yeah, but then.
Yes, he had chosen him, but had he made it known? Yeah, Moses,
like
Aaron.
Deal, and God said, Aaron can talk for you, so.
That's the difference, though. God told him he could. God told him, Aaron will be your mouthpiece. Because remember, Moses' big complaint was, I can't, you know, I'm stuttered, stammer, I can't speak well. And he goes, Aaron will go with you and be your mouthpiece.
Yeah.
Moses was to be God's mouthpiece, and through Aaron, it would be shared. I just find it interesting. Maybe I got us in too deep of a ditch right there than what was necessary, but I just find it interesting that Joshua went. God didn't tell him to. He didn't tell him not to. Granted, I just think.
Be some kind of, I mean, Moses had to know in some way that it was okay because God had gave such strict instructions before. I mean, just seems like he didn't question.
Yeah. Maybe the fact that Moses wouldn't have been able to physically make it up there at all had not Joshua helped him. Could that show us something about how much Joshua loved Moses and wasn't just his servant or his attendant? He was a servant, his attendant, but there again, I'm getting down in the ditch. It's an interesting ditch to look around in, but let's get back out of it. I got us there, so I'll dig us back out. But to the elders, he said. So I think that's interesting too. It's almost like he didn't tell Joshua no, did he? But it says, but to the elders, he said. So they may have all stood up too. He's like, no, y'all sit back down. Joshua can go.
It happened, and God knows it happens.
So obviously it was okay, right? And part of the plan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Remain here for us until we return, and behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach him. I can't help but think Aaron at this point would be like, come on, man, look at everything I've been through, and I don't get to go up there, but this young guy does. But he says, no, you got an important job. Y'all are to handle disputes among the people while I'm gone. He kind of handed him that mantle of leadership in his absence. And then we read, Moses went up to the mountain and the cloud covered the mountain. They don't need a whole lot of explanation there. And the glory of Yahweh the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. Do y'all see what happened right there? Come up here. Moses gets up there, and God says, how many people went here prior military besides me? I know Mike Hill and a couple of y'all. This is the hurry up and wait to me. You hurry up and get there, and then he's going to wait 6 days. Do y'all see that in the verse? 6 days.
I get the feeling that that meal had some special qualities to it because Moses isn't going to eat for quite a while.
Yeah, we're going to see. Does it say it here or does it say it later? It doesn't say it here, but he doesn't eat for the 40 days and 40 nights. And 6 plus 7 before he ever enters into the clouds. So 47, almost 50 days. So, Yahweh dwelt on Mount Sinai. What's that say? The cloud, the glory of the Lord came down and did not move, did not leave, was present on the top of the mountain. And Moses is right outside waiting for 6 days. The verb translated for dwelt in the original Hebrew, shakin, it's kind of anticipatory for what comes next. When God describes the commands for building the temple and the sanctuary and the Ark of the Testimony, all that comes next in the next chapters when he gives them the directives of how to build this stuff and when to build it and how, all this kind of stuff. That word kind of ties into all that of being the tabernacle as a dwelling place of God. He's dwelling on the mountain. He said, you're going to build something for me to dwell in with the people. All this is kind of pointing to that. What is the 6-7 formula? 6-7 day formula bring our mind back to once again? Creation. Brings us right back to creation. The exact opposite happened, right? It's almost like he's outside waiting and resting for 6 days, and then the 7th day is when he moves in. Verse 16 tells us the glory was there. You might just think, well, that's just the cloud, right? The glory cloud we've been talking about. Well, verse 17 gives us some more details. And the appearance of the glory of Yahweh the Lord was like a consuming fire. We finally got there, Susan. Was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop in the eyes of the sons of Israel. So as they saw it on top of the mountain, the sons of Israel, we're talking about the larger group now, right? So where are they at? They're down on the bottom, right? They're not even on the mountain. They're not even touching them, but they're down there. It appeared to them as a consuming fire.
That's one of the reasons they were sure Moses was coming down, because they thought they'd be burned up.
Yeah. What is a consuming fire? Was it, is a consuming fire a different kind of fire? That's the one that you pour the gas on, like what Charles said earlier. But this is Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. The burning bush was mentioned. That it, yeah, it was not a consuming fire.
I'm thinking health.
Okay. And that's, it says that's how it appeared in their eyes, right? These are the same people who just had heard out, had just went through this covenantal stuff and this blessing and peace and protection and all this kind of stuff, and we're going to do everything you say, God, and then they see this.
Maybe they thought Moses was the final sacrifice. And
I don't know, mate.
I think they kind of were worried that he might not have survived, because they did kind of take things over.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's ahead of things. But
a little bit, yeah.
It's hard, Diane, because we know.
It's almost like they'd reverted back already, right? Before anything really ever started happening, they'd already reverted back to their... Seems like there's a little bit more fear starting to creep in already. They see it as a this consuming fire. What's a consuming fire do? Doesn't leave it. It burns everything, right? Consuming, it devours. Y'all seen these wildfires like out west in California? So like that, when the fire spreads, it levels everything. Might have a little twig sticking up here and there. Sometimes they get so hot and burn so much that there's not even much of a foundation left on some of them homes.
I saw that a week or so ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
so,
King James said devouring.
A devouring fire. I've got that in parentheses right here. Consuming, devouring, which it means the same thing, right? It totally destroys it. But devouring and consuming actually have another meaning to it, because it's not just that it destroys, it's like it eats it up.
Purification.
What's that?
It's another purification.
Yeah. So, are they looking at God now of, he could consume us? If they are, they're looking at him right, at least. Consuming fire typically is an image of destruction. I referenced in Malachi Sunday morning, if y'all were paying attention, Malachi 3 talks about a fire as what? That was the purifying, the refiner's fire, right? Where it burned off the impurities for us. We didn't read chapter 4. I told you if you wanted to read it when you got home, you could. But chapter 4 does talk about a devouring, consuming fire for the wicked.
This just looked in their eyes like a consuming fire, which doesn't mean it was.
Absolutely. So their perspective of what they were looking at, for sure.
Themselves.
Yeah. Well, where's another example of a consuming fire? Before we close, Leviticus 10:2 is an example of a consuming fire. Let me read that for you. And fire came out from the presence of Yahweh and consumed them, and they died before Yahweh. There's an example of a consuming fire. Numbers 26:10. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up along with, anybody know who we're talking about? Korah. Korah's rebellion. When that congregation died, when the fire consumed 250 men so that they became a warning. You also got to think about this blistering, hot, flaming, roaring type of fire. You're not going to look at a fire or look at something and think it's a consuming, all-devouring fire if it's like a little kindling getting a fire started. This had to be like blazing in their eyes. Verse 18. They're looking up and seeing this. To Diane's point, they're looking up and seeing this. Then verse 18. Then Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. This is a little more, the scene has shifted dramatically from what we've been talking about in Exodus, hasn't it? What's that? I'm sorry.
They hadn't dealt with any 40-day period.
No, we hadn't seen it in Exodus so in the Israel.
40 days might not have even registered, you know, as something that they ought to wait for.
They wandered for 40 years.
Yeah, but they hadn't got to that point yet, though. That's what she's saying. They haven't got to these stages of 40 yet.
So they don't have that concept. They might have to wait.
Yeah, none of the plagues lasted that long. None of that.
Yeah,
they haven't.
He was in the wilderness 40 years, but they don't know that.
They don't know that yet.
Well, I'm talking about he was when he was here 40.
Yes.
But that's not something.
Right. So what about this length of time Moses spent? Is this just thrown in there? Hey, we've got it here. Well, actually, it's referenced in Exodus 34:28, Deuteronomy 9:9, Deuteronomy 9:11, 9:18, Deuteronomy 10:10. Several other times. It doesn't say it here yet. It's mentioned that the prophet didn't eat or drink the entire time. Those whole 40 days. The number 40 is often used as a period of time of what? Trial, testing. It's also, some say 70, 40 to 70, but 70 is also a number of completion. But trial and testing we see a lot. 40 days and 40 nights, rain. It also can symbolize a time of purification. Genesis 50, chapter 50, verse 3. Then the 40 days to do this were fulfilled because in this manner the days of embalming were fulfilled and the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Whose death is that talking about? Y'all remember? That's your homework. Yeah. Or just an extended period of time is often used in that way. All those other verses talk about eating and drinking. So, does the New Testament speak of Jesus as like, talks about him as the second Adam, but what connection does it make to Jesus and Moses?
Jesus was tempted 40
days in the wilderness. You find that account in three of the Gospels, the Synoptics, Matthew 4, Mark chapter 1, and Luke chapter 4 all talk about that happening. Okay. What did Jesus not do those 40 days? He didn't eat or drink. He fasted for 40 days when he was in the wilderness. In Matthew 17, 1 through 9, Jesus goes on a high mountain with his disciples. Who do they see there?
Moses and Elijah.
Back to what Charles was saying just a minute ago. That's Matthew 17. These experiences, I think, remind us of Moses and his experiences in the wilderness, Sinai as this mediator between God and man, the covenant. They also demonstrate the fulfillment of a prophecy given through Moses about Jesus in the connection. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15. This is one of them earmarked passages right here. Deuteronomy 18, verse 15. Yahweh, the Lord your God. Moses. Okay, this is a prophecy from Moses. From God through Moses. Will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. You shall listen to him. What's that, Diane? I've got 18:15. What's 18:18? That prophet like me was Christ. Well, 15 and 18 both say it. Verse 15 and verse 18 both say it. Moses was placed in the ark, a small little ark. Jesus is the ark of our salvation, as we talked about a couple of Sundays ago. All these connections. Jesus is the great shepherd. Moses is a lesser, but a great shepherd, not the great shepherd, and shepherding the people. All these connections. Jesus, of course, is much greater, much higher, not even comparable to them, but they're types. Types of Christ. Any other thoughts? Kind of interesting. Moses is given this prophecy that somebody will raise it up like me in the future. He's also, people kind of joke too. There's a text that says no one was ever as humble as Moses, and Moses wrote that. But yeah, the meekest of them all, Moses. Any other thoughts? We covered a whole chapter tonight. It's been a while since we've done that. We had to go over time to do it, but we did it.
Just what if you're a mortal man and you're not supported by God, you are not going to make it 40 days and 40 nights without food.
Do you hear what Brother Jim said?